Hello, everyone. I'm Trent Luce. Welcome to another edition of Rural Routes, the program where we gather every day at this time. Well, Jim Rutt, we do it Monday through Friday anyway. And what we do when we gather is continue to address the issues between rural and urban America. Joining us from the hills and hollers of Southern Virginia, Jim Rutt.
Hey, Trent.
You didn't get the memo, but you know why we wear red shirts on Friday, right, Jim?
No, can't say that I do.
After World War II, the ladies' auxiliary within the VFW suggested that every Friday, all men, women, and children should wear a red shirt just as a subtle gesture to say thank you to those boys and girls returning from the beaches of France and Italy in the South Pacific. And so I thought that's a good idea now. For so for 20 years, every Friday, I've worn this red shirt.
That's kind of cool. My dad was a Marine in the South Pacific in World War II, 3rd Division, took part in 3 invasions, and was a longtime member of the VFW, but he never told me about this.
Well, first of all, I appreciate his service, and secondly, I can't believe he wouldn't tell you.
Yeah, I don't know why, but it's an interesting concept, and I think, as I mentioned, I'm not sure I even own a Richard. I do have one red flannel hunting shirt.
That would work.
That would work, I suppose, but I may have to lay in a supply.
I got to say thanks to Vance Crowe for putting you and I together. I think I'm going to thank him. Maybe I'll wait for 48 minutes and see if I thank him.
Vance is an interesting young fellow who recently got connected to, and he's turned me on to all kinds of cool stuff like virtual reality and you and various other things. Definitely a great connector.
Yeah, he truly is. And he's like an old soul in a young body. That's what I like about him.
Yeah, and he's got a truly questing mind, and he's truly open. You know, he's one of those people who does not come in with a bunch of reflexive judgments. He will listen to almost anything, and then he'll make a decision based on his values, which is the way we should all be.
And you have taken it upon yourself to start your own podcast and been interviewing and visiting with interesting people for how many years now?
It'll be 2 years in June, and that's the Jim Rutt Show, available on 150 different podcasting apps.
Really? 150?
Yep.
Why so many?
Fortunately, I didn't have to do the work to do the, or my producer didn't have to do the work. But once you get up on a critical mass of podcasting platforms, then others basically take those feeds. And
But
we have a way to keep track of which ones we're up on. And we're up on almost all of them now and around the world. In fact, one of the things I really pride myself on is my audience is only about 50% in the U.S. We have a very international audience of folks.
So what really impresses me is that you do the show, the Jim Rutt Show, in English, and then you redo it in Portuguese so that people around the world can understand it.
Well, man, fortunately, English is the lingua franca of podcasting.
Yeah. What's your overall mission in life, Jim?
To leave the world better than I found it, or actually to awesome. Help bring into being a civilization that we will, that we are proud to, that we love to live in and are proud to leave to our children and grandchildren.
I think we still have some work to do.
You almost
did it.
I almost did it. Yeah, I can't. Yeah, we're on the air here, so I can't say my favorite 7 words. But that's okay. I will. I still have my gestures under the table here, etc. But yeah, no, we're not even hardly started, truthfully. And in fact, I would argue we're still on a downward arc. You know, and it's at some point we're putting energy. Think of it as, you know, I have a physics background, so I think of it as a series of dynamical systems. And so the ball is still rolling down like this. Maybe the rate of decline is slowing a little. And those of us putting good work into changing it will bring it down. It'll hit a bottom and then it'll start back up. And as we keep applying energy, it'll go up higher and higher. And that's how I think about my mission in life. And unfortunately, I am 67. So whether I'll how far the ball will move in my lifetime, I'm not sure. But frankly, that's not for us to decide. You know, all we can do, as Gandalf said in The Lord of the Rings, is deal with the times that we are dealt and do the best we can while we're here and hope to pass on, you know, good work to other people to complete the mission.
I know that it sounds like me just whining, but I'm perplexed by the number of people, Jim, that are willing to accept things at face value and be completely misled. And I'm not just talking about politically. I'm talking about every realm of life, and let somebody else control your thoughts. It's like, You know, one day my favorite quote, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., in about 2003, Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, he said, "Trent, I got to get you to quit living in my head rent-free." We have media living in people's head rent-free, and I want to just shake people and say, wake up, just ask more questions. Don't just take it at face value. Can we get over that hump, Jim?
It's really difficult right now, and you know, particularly our mass media, especially the mainstream media, what those of us in the Game B world call the blue church, have essentially unified in a perspective which is substantially false, and yet they repeat it endlessly, so that people who are not using serious discernment on their media inputs basically have their brains captured. You know, this new woke thing is the most recent example. In fact, I refer to it as a brain virus, and the virus has been propagated by the blue church mass media. And how do we find it? Our recommendation, and I'll step back a little bit and say, our world is now so complex and so fast moving that it's probably beyond the cognitive ability of most individual humans to make sense of it. So we have to engage in collective sense-making with people who share similar values and similar outlooks. So the first thing you have to do is find the others, so that you can find a bubble of sanity in which one can actually make sense of the world.
I'm stealing that, by the way, and probably won't give you credit. Collective sense-making. That's huge.
Yeah, one of the things we focus on, one of the core foundations of our Game B movement, is that we need to work together to discern reality collectively and share it with honesty and good faith with ourselves and anybody else who will listen.
All right, so you're teasing us two times, so third time I'll bite. Game B, take us there. What are you doing?
Yeah, Game B. It's a work a group of us started back in 2013 with the modest ambition of creating a completely new social operating system for humanity, at least for the West. Mm-hmm. You know, one that addresses the many problems that we see in our current operating system, which, surprise, surprise, we call Game A. And, you know, we now have thousands of people working on
that's collective sense making right there. If you got Game A, you got to go to Game B.
There's some deep thinking for you, right? I will confess that even after, 8 years, our work is very incomplete. And in fact, one of the lenses we use in our work is the lens of complexity, which, you know, basically holds that it's really hard to predict, particularly about the future, right? So, and we proceed with some modesty and experimentally that we say, all right, here are our theories. Let's try something. Were our theories correct? Yes or no. If they were, all right, that's good. We take a small step. If they were wrong, we adjust our theories. And, of course, what that sounds a lot like is the method of science, and that's by design. Many of the people involved in the Game B movement have science backgrounds or business backgrounds or other backgrounds where they have to deal with reality. What a concept, right?
So, Jim, for the past 20 years, I've dedicated a great part of every day to try to educate people about who produces their food, where it comes from, the challenges along with that, and that food production is a means of national security. And in those 20 years, you said something that really triggered some thoughts, and that is that we always want a silver bullet. We want to fix this problem by tomorrow. You just told me it takes a recipe and you have to take small steps, because look how many generations it took to get here. We have to get away from it as well in small steps.
Absolutely. And small and medium steps. And we also have to take each step with humility, realizing we might be wrong, right? I was a business guy for 25 years, did everything from raw startups, three people and a Xerox machine back in 1982, when the first thing you bought was a Xerox machine, believe it or not, up to being a corporate executive for some pretty big companies. And, we did some audacious stuff. But I think one of the reasons on average we were successful was that we didn't believe our own stuff. I was going to get and use one of those words I wasn't supposed to use. And I caught myself and be aggressive, but not be self-deluding
in believing, you know, any kind of ideological formula has all the answers. You know, it's you know, the world is real. I mean, that's the first. And weirdly, this new group of postmodernist thinkers, they're not sure the world is real. I mean, I don't know what their heads must be like to live in a mind space where you don't believe in reality. But I fundamentally believe in reality, and that every time we do something, we're testing our ideas and our systems against reality. And reality has the last vote, right? You know, it's you try planting corn in southern New Mexico without any irrigation, and I can tell you what's going to happen. Most likely, it ain't going to work. Right?
Well, a lot of people apparently need to try it just to see that it won't work. Hey, Jim, I have to take a break. I'm going to run over. I've got two daughters, 18 and 15, that are still home, and ask them what a Xerox machine is. I don't think they'll know. I need to remind you that Lone Creek Cattle Company is providing the opportunity to be a part of the brand of beef business. That's about putting more money in your pocket for the quality of beef that you produce. Marlon Will has your details. LoneCreekCattleCo.com. Find Marlon. We'll be back with more Jim Rutt. And I think this might be the Jim Rutt Show right here. Don't know. More after this. Welcome back. Rural Route, Trent Luce on a Red Shirt Friday, where we say thank you. I just got turned on to several Thomas Sowell quotes this morning. He was a Marine. Did you know he was a Marine?
I think I vaguely recall that from his I read, you know, I used to read pretty much all the books that he wrote, but it's been a while since I've kept up with him.
Born in the 1930s, he's still kicking.
He was born in 1930. Yeah, yeah, obviously he was too a mere kid, didn't make the big one, but like my dad. But he was probably a Marine during Korea.
He was. He was a Marine in Korea. Absolutely. So are we making progress in this regard of taking small steps, acting like we're the two-step, two up, one back? Hopefully we're two up, one back, not one up, two back.
And sometimes you're one up, two back, right? And you have to realize that if you're willing to be audacious, you have to be prepared to fail, right? So our current assessment, we call a situational assessment, is the main trajectories of the system are still negative. But there are lots of people doing good work in their own worlds and are getting wiser about moving the world in the right direction. But as I start out with, probably the net effect of the good and the bad is the world is still getting worse, but maybe at a slower rate than it was before. But if we keep pushing and we keep recruiting people to the cause of the good, eventually the forces applied against the bad will counteract it and will turn, hopefully before we self-destruct, which is not guaranteed, and then the world will start to get better. Because there's a glorious future for humanity. We have an amazing future if we don't avoid a whole series of failure modes here in the next 100 years or so.
Well, we're told 1,000 years of glorious time after we get through that little bit of uncomfortable time. But I'm not sure we created the right visual for Game B. What more detail can you give us about how this is working and how do I enroll?
Well, first, if you want to find the others, we recently had a little war with Facebook where all the administrators of the Game B group were kicked off for about 10 hours. And,
imagine that.
Jesus. And, you know, for no obvious reason, they never tell you. It's, you know, this Kafkaesque black box. But anyway, we decided we had enough of Facebook. And so we built our own site at game-b.org. And it'll ask you, we're not really open for the public yet, though we're happy to have people listen to the show. It'll ask you where you heard about it. Just say on the Trent Luce Show or Luce Trails or Jim Rutt told you, whatever, and we'll let you in. And there are now a few thousand people who are doing this work. And again, we're working on the theory of what a social operating system for the future of humanity looks like. But this is perhaps of even more interest to the audience. Mm-hmm. We're also making the turn towards the practical. We are just about to launch the first proto-bees, as we call them, which are on-the-ground communities of people living by Game B ethos and by Game B methods. The first project has actually bought its land out in Oregon. I think another one will close before the end of the year in British Columbia, where we'll actually start trying our ideas out. And I think one of the things that you talk about, the bridge between the urban and the rural, at least the first couple of proto bees are almost certainly going to be in rural areas, where people, many of them from urban areas, will relocate, to, you know, live closer in a righteous way with the land, produce some, if not all, of their own food, interact with honesty and good faith with the local communities, not like a bunch of haughty city people, and build a society that actually bridges both the urban and the rural. And if we're successful, next year we could have 5 or 10 proto bees launched, and the year after that, 100, and build, and essentially demonstrate that our ideas make sense and actually work.
And you said that you're starting with this first proto bee in Oregon. You talk about a state that makes California look normal. Wow.
Yeah. Why? No, it varies. Why Oregon's highly variable. You know, parts of Oregon, you know, you go to eastern Oregon and it's not much different than Idaho, right? You know, on the other hand, western Oregon, you know, you know, if there's one, place in America crazier than San Francisco, I suspect it's Portland, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, you're speaking of the eastern half of Oregon. Is these people are in a wilderness and they just can't be, because some of my dearest friends live in Harney County, Oregon, and much of my last 10 years have been shaped by the happenings at Malheur National Wildlife Refuge and what the Hammond family is still dealing with, and what their permits are on, their permits are off. But they just live in a world where they yell at the top of their lungs, and the people from a, because I believe in states' rights like nobody else. And you are lost if you're in the eastern half of Oregon trying to yell about what's really important to the state of Oregon or the nation.
Yeah, and another game B idea is very congruent with this, which is not just states' rights, but the idea of subsidiarity, which is a doctrine we borrowed from all the weird places, the Catholic Church, which states that every issue should be dealt with at the lowest level possible that is congruent with the solution of the issue. So, for instance, schools really ought to be completely under the control of a local community. You know, policing, you know, should be at the level of control of a local community. How much policing you want, y'all decide, right? And on up, you know, some things require global coordination. There aren't very many, but there's a few. But one should rigorously think about everything that has to do with anything that involves coercion or regulation, and have that regulation set. So, I mean, to my mind, even the state level is too large. I mean, Virginia has about 8 million people, and it's a highly diverse state with the coastal plain on one end and where we are in the mountains on the other, you know, the northern around D.C., which some of us refer to as Union-occupied Virginia, all the way down to the peanut country down on the North Carolina border. And so, you know, for my taste, even in a state like Virginia, is too big, you know, to be the domain for an awful lot. And something like county sovereignty would be great. Much more authority to the counties, which Virginia is unfortunately a state-centered county government, where the state has absolute control over the counties under something called the Dillon Rule. And there are many of us who believe the Dillon Rule should be repealed and that there should be specific grants of much more authority to the counties.
I get you're generating too many thoughts for me to categorize them here, Jim. First of all, your county idea is really novel, and it only started about 1781, when we finalized a little thing called the Constitution that was all about the county is the driver. Everybody else just falls in line. And secondly, speaking of state initiatives, which are troubling, and I'm going to Colorado to deal with a couple of those tomorrow and tonight, I get more calls from Virginia about animal rights initiatives in that state and boards that are created to come out and police animal care than any other state at this moment. I don't know what you have going on in Virginia, but it's pretty severe.
Yeah, none of it's turning out here. I mean, we're in a very, very remote area where agriculture and timber are the two main industries. And like I say, we don't got any of them people around here. And you know, we
actually, I think you do. You just don't know it because you are in a remote area. But I get calls from veterinarians who are very troubled by some of the state animal care boards that have recently been established with people who, again, want to just end animal agriculture.
Yeah,
I'll get you more information on that.
Yeah, that'd be great. Certainly here, one of the projects my wife and I were involved with was setting up a local slaughter facility in the county. And we're in a very rural county. It used to be the producers had to haul their animals over three mountain ranges to the processing plant. Mm-hmm. And now we have our own. And that's been a big boon, and it's allowed our producers to move up the value-added chain, where many of them are able to market directly to restaurants or to end consumers and make a lot more money. To do that, you have to have a slaughter facility. And amazingly, we also have 55 of our producers as investors, most of them small investors, in the slaughter facility.
That's the future of food production right there. You just described it. How did you put that together? And I have 1 minute, and I'm going to cut you off.
It took us 7 years to put it together, but we talked with lots of people. We got the extension service involved. We got the design from Virginia Tech, from the agriculture department down there. And so it was a community-wide effort. And then we raised the money in the community. Every single penny of the investment which was $1 million, came from the community. As I said, about half the money came from producers, and the rest came from other folks. And that's basically how we did it.
And what species do you harvest there?
Cattle, number one. Sheep, lambs, number two. It's beautiful lamb country here. Some of the best lamb in the world. Chefs love Highland County lamb. Interestingly, we didn't put it in the business plan, but since the facility opened, pork production has skyrocketed because, pork is a very nice, fast-cycle business, right? You can turn it around a lot faster. And so there's been a completely unexpected growth in pork production.
Yeah, we need to go to a break. We'll be back. More Jim Rutt. I want to remind you about Neogen. Now, Jim just talked about the harvesting end and the community coming together to say, we're going to take care of this food security issue ourselves. But if you want to look at what the genomics are so that you get a guaranteed eating quality and high performance every single time, you need to look at those DNA fingerprints. They're called alleles, and they can be found by going to Neogen. Well, you find out how to find them by going to Neogen. Neogen.com to get details about shining a light on your genetic future. Second half of Rural Route, just ahead. Welcome back to Rural Route. Trent Luce alongside Jim Rutt joining us from Highland County, Virginia. I just absolutely am fascinated with your community slaughterhouse and what absolutely needs to be done. You mentioned pork production, the growth in that type of pig production. By the way, I don't know that you know, I do have 100 sows, and we have 100 sows, 100 cows, and 25 horses, and I sell boars. And the accelerated demand for boars and semen to people in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York. I have not had any calls from Virginia, but I know my friend Jim Petrick has. It has created this new level of awareness and opportunity. And as you described, it's a huge growth area. By the way, because it's such a huge growth area, I don't know if you saw this or not, but excuse me, this past weekend, the USDA indicated that they were going to start surveying producers with less than 1,000 pigs or more, and they want to know every detail about how you're producing pigs because they want to position themselves better for trade with particularly China. What a load of bovine fecal matter. Nobody with 1,000 pigs or more is in selling in a market channel that ends up in China. They're just trying to figure out who's got what where so that they can keep track of us. We don't need that kind of oversight.
Yeah, I mean, every one of our producers is selling locally to end users or to restaurants. It's an amazing growth because, as I said, literally there was no hog production here at all. That would have been about 2010 2012 when we put the business plan together. And now there's a lot. And, it's these interesting experimentations with, breeds. People who are doing all heritage, but they found the production rates were pretty slow there. So now there's Hampshire, heritage crosses, which are what a lot of people are doing. And of course, a lot of this is driven by the pathetically bad quality of grocery store pork, where the big producers have reduced the fat content down to nothing and the pork doesn't taste good, right? So, one of the driving factors has been people who want that, that richer, fatter, marbled, pork like days of yore. And, people have been experimenting, with these genetic lines, as you say, to find what's both a very good quality product and which can grow at a rate that's economical. And of course, we have to live in both worlds simultaneously.
You've just described my world. You don't know it, but you just described my world. We raise spots. We have some Berks, but our spots are comparable and been working very hard on the meat quality, and they're easier to raise. They grow faster. And I want to speak to this because this isn't just about pork production. This is about the bigger picture. So in my lifetime, Jim, I've personally cared for more than 1 million head of livestock, most of those being pigs. And in 1979, when I decided this is what I really wanted to do, we were starting to get that message from the consumer. We want this pork leaner. We got to make this pork leaner. And we would brag. We'd brag about 34% leaner than it was in 1980. We just took all of the taste out of there on a perceived notion that was incorrect. And then we coined the whole phrase pork, the other white meat, because everybody wants chicken, right? And so chicken, because it's convenient and it's cheap, that's why they want chicken, but everybody's buying chicken. So we try to be like chicken. And then we bred all of the quality and taste out of it, because when you have a pale white pork chop, as you just described, that means that you don't have marbling, you don't have pH, and you don't have tenderness. So we've created an inferior product because we thought we were following a consumer trend instead of saying, people, if you want a good eating experience with pork, here's what you need to do. And I think there's a bigger lesson about life in general and the whole game B concept that I hear you talking about here. They're all tied in parallel.
And that's, you know, to actually think. Another game B platitude, if you want to call it that, is to engage in real thinking, not simulated thinking. I would argue that the resonances around turning pork into the other white meat was simulated thinking. People were kind of not getting to first principles, which is why do we like our pork nice and fat? Because it tastes good, right?
Yeah.
And then we were also propagandized by some misinformation from the nutrition people that fat was bad for you. Well, guess what? It turns out it's not bad for you. It turns out fat is good for you.
Yeah, it's essential.
It's what make your brain big, right? Yeah. The myelination of your neurons requires fat. And, I've even heard of crazy people feeding their babies low-fat milk. Nothing worse you could do. Babies need fat. Everyone needs fat. And so this was simulated thinking. We were caught up in these cycles of repeating nonsense, essentially, instead of getting down to the essentials.
You know, Matthew Bush just said something that's spot on. Fat tastes good, and it drives – I mean, it's what makes you want to eat something. Who would have ever thought that God would create something that made it taste good that wasn't good for you? It only makes sense that if it tastes good, you should eat it. And I'm not suggesting anything other than all things in moderation, but it just goes against logical thinking. I like that simulated thinking.
Yeah, it's you get caught in these loops of people saying baloney to each other. See, there again, I was a good boy. I said baloney rather than what I was actually thinking.
Well,
right?
Baloney was essential during World War II to keep people alive. You know that, so this served a purpose too. Baloney.
Yeah. Oh, in fact, my dad was a great proponent of spam, which out in the South Pacific was covered with spam. And even when I was a kid, one of his special breakfasts that he'd cook is get a can of spam out, slice it, fry it up real good, and have it with some eggs. It was good.
You know, if you go to Austin, Minnesota, the home of Hormel, they will tell you that it was spam that won World War II for the Allies. It would not been for spam, we would not have won.
I don't know if I go that
far. Hey, it is Hormel's systematic thinking. So don't screw that their marketing program. But yeah,
buddies worked at the Hormel plant in Austin, Minnesota during the summer.
Oh, really?
Farm boy from Albert Lea, Minnesota, which is just north Austin, and he worked pushing a gut wagon in the slaughterhouse each year because it was the best paying job he could find.
Just 24 miles from Austin, to be exact. What did your dad think about lamb?
My dad loved lamb. My mother hated lamb.
That's interesting because we're told that lamb consumption, we only consume a half a pound per person in the United States per capita per year. And we're told that's because the GIs come home from World War II and they had horrible mutton there. And so nobody ever went. I had people in Canada tell me that. And I was in Australia and I had people tell me that. I'm like, is this a real story or is this something we've made up?
Yeah, I don't know. For whatever reason, my dad loved lamb. We'd have lamb chops. We'd have leg of lamb usually for Easter. My mother, who was a farm girl, grew up in a tenant farm in the swamps of northern Minnesota, and they had sheep. She loathed them. I would also say here in Highland County, most people the old traditional people will not eat lamb. This is a pretty funny story. One of our neighbors, when we first, got here, we leased a little, one of our pastures to her for her, sheep. And we bought a lamb, had it, slaughtered elsewhere before we had our own slaughter facility. Right. And she took care of it for us while this was back in the days when we were just weekenders down here. And she called us, as soon as she got it, said, could you please come and get this lamb out of my freezer? She didn't even want lamb in her freezer.
Might cross contaminate the beef or something.
Exactly. You know. Right.
What about your father and horse meat?
My father actually had horse meat, and he would be somewhat defensive about people that were opposed to it, but we never had any, needless to say.
You know why I ask you that? Because in 1949, Texas passed a law banning the consumption of horse meat because World War II veterans came home and they learned that they like horse meat. They didn't know they liked horse meat. And Texas cattlemen got so worried about the impact of horse meat that they sponsored and lobbied and passed a bill banning the consumption of horse meat in 1949. And case in point, we now have cattlemen fighting, trying to get horse harvesting back open in the United States. But we created our own problem because we thought we were protecting ourselves.
Interesting. Yeah, and Virginia is very anti-horse slaughter. It's illegal, I believe, to have do horse slaughtering in Virginia because Virginia is a classic racehorse state in the center around Middleburg. Mm-hmm. And there's great romanticism, the cavalier tradition of the horse. So there's a very strong bias against horse meat production in Virginia, to be sure.
Yeah.
They'd probably lynch you if you try. That I can't imagine trying to sell that one here right now.
Well, we haven't been able to sell it anywhere, Jim, since 2008. I used to spend a lot of time on this, and we had three plants still in my day. We had two in Texas, one in Illinois. It's the Texas issue. That's how it came to be. It was because they found out that it was illegal to consume horse meat, so they went ahead and took the next step and said, we shouldn't be harvesting them either. But there's so many misnomers, and that really comes back to what we're talking about in today's world, is that people grab a hold of some headline instead of really digging in and looking at what do we do with unwanted horses. It's just the basics of life.
Yep. And, we have in the far west, we have, a large amount of Mustangs, wild horses that are, depleting the environment, and you got to send people out to shoot them. And then what do you do with it?
Mm-hmm. I've long proposed, and now you're talking about something that I've spent a lot of time on. And every Monday on this program, we have Hank Vogler, who ranches in Nevada. So he talks about the overpopulation of wild horses. And I've long proposed that we have a hunting season for those Mustangs, because the problem is the satellite Mustangs get beat out by their father, and they go live on the outside and they cause all of the problems. If we just had a hunting season, paid the Department of Interior $5,000 to go hunt a Mustang, we'd solve a lot of problems. But that doesn't fly either, as you might figure out.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to propose that in Virginia, I could tell. Of course, we do have a few wild boars here, and then they're a big
really
down, not our area. They're down in the far southwestern part of the state. And Virginia does have a rule, shoot on sight, day or night with a light, from a helicopter with a machine gun. Right. So we have been smart about that. The infestation of wild boars, which have been, horrible in places like Texas and Georgia and parts of Tennessee, et cetera.
$70 million worth of farm crops a year destroyed each year in Texas right now by wild boars, wild hogs.
Yeah.
They're not kind little critters. We have to take a break. We are at that final segment. We will come back. Certified Piedmontese, Neogen working together. They're two separate entities, but the Lone Creek Cattle Company system does use the Neogen DNA fingerprint testing. We test every single calf we raise to make sure the myostatin gene is there. It's a mutant myostatin gene. Basically, that myostatin gene regulates muscle growth. And this mutant gene does not regulate growth. It's present, but the muscle just continues to grow. And when it grows, it happens to be tender. That's kind of the science behind why certified Piedmontese is so tender. Get details at LoneCreekCattleCo.com. More Rural Route, the last segment with Jim Rutt after this. Welcome back. Rural Route, Trent Luce on a Red Shirt Friday. Jim Rutt, I've been driving this conversation, Jim. I think in the last segment here, you need to drive the conversation. What do we need to talk about? What do people need to think about?
Yeah, the biggest thing we need to think about is how do we become sane again, right? And truthfully, again, this rural-urban thing in our Game B ethos, we're not at all convinced that big urban life is really congruent with being a good human being. Mm-hmm. You know, I've lived in rural. I've lived in urban. Much prefer rural. And when I go to New York City, which I still do, the one picture that always comes away from me is riding the subway. Because you're going to be in New York, might as well be a real New Yorker and ride the subway. And everybody's either looking at their shoes or looking to their looking at their phone. They're not looking at each other in the eye. They're not talking. There's no sociability. People don't know who their next door neighbor is in their apartment building they've been living next to for 15 years. And so, you know, learning how to live as real humans again is something we're going to have to develop from scratch for a lot of people. And that's part of our Game B, particularly our Proto B ideas. And in fact, what we're thinking about is that people can live in rural areas, be at least partially self-sufficient in food and perhaps in other things also, like clothing and furniture, but be radically engaged in the work of the world but with cooperation with other proto-bees and with other businesses. And as we say, actively parasitize Game A by being better at Game A than Game A itself, partially because we're more sane as people. We haven't driven ourselves crazy by living at 10,000 people per square mile. And instead we have focused on, you know, true human life. And that would, and particularly includes how we raise our children. And this is one of my particular interests is that, you know, we have to have an education system that really educates children with good values rather than indoctrinates them with perverse ideologies, that teaches them not just book learning, but in my view, every kid should have a trade in addition to their book learning. I mean, I was a good book learning nerd myself, but I was glad that I picked up some trade-like things along the way. You know, and the other thing that I'm a strong believer of is the two-parent family needs to come back. And, you know, these kinds of good fundamental values, are going to be necessary for the recovery of our sanity, literally. And insane people do not make good decisions. And we have an awful lot of people who are functionally insane, even though they don't know it.
So Tim Pike brings up a good idea, a thought process here. You just described something in New York. That I completely agree with everything you said. I'm hollering at the top of my lungs. Hear, hear. But how many of those people who are on the subway looking at their phone, looking at their shoes, won't look at you, are happy being that way? They think that they've won the lottery or something. So we cannot at the same time impose our values on them.
I agree. And this is a very important point. And this is another Game B philosophy. We do not believe in coercion. We believe instead in seduction, that we will have a way of life that is so clearly better that gradually, one at a time, individual humans will make the choice to vote with their feet. Analogously, how did the Soviet Union fall, right? It fell from seduction. People saw you know, and heard about how much better the life was where you had freedom. And they eventually just rebelled. We see something like that happening between Game A and Game B, though more gradually. So we are not going to coerce anybody to do anything. Rather, we're going to put out a model. And this is come visit. And part of our expansion model is actually including Airbnbs in most proto-Bs. So people from the city can come hang out with us and see if our way of life is better or not and decide for themselves.
And then we lead to this conflict. I'm throwing up what ifs because this isn't a what if. It's happened to look at Colorado, which is top of mind for me today. When the people who are used to and accustomed to the city life come and live in Sherman County, Nebraska, well, I don't want that dirt road, so we got to pave our roads. And I can't have a well on my place, so I got to have public water. They start bringing all of those values that they wanted to leave and try to recreate what they left.
Yeah, that kind of people drive me crazy. When we first moved out to a somewhat rural area, we were next to one of the largest dairy farms in the region, and we were fine with it. We know what a dairy farm is like, and every spring he would spread his manure from the big manure tanks out on the fields, and it smelled like well fermented manure for 2 or 3 days. Somebody else moved out there near us, and they called us up. Well, we need to call the health department. There's a horrible smell coming off the fields over there. And we said, well, what do you expect? You move next to the largest dairy operation in Loudoun County, Virginia. This is what the man does for a living, and his priority comes long before ours. And you'd be nuts. And people will laugh at you and think you're a clown if you were to do that. So I'm well aware of that. And I will say that the one of our Game B ethos is we're good neighbors, right? We are not disrespectful of the people that are here. And I have certainly learned that, living here in a rural area, and we've come to appreciate the realities of it. In fact, even here, one of our neighbors has a big turkey operation, and another come here said, hey, you could protest this guy's turkey operation because of this, that, and the other thing. I say, well, why the heck would I want to do that? It's allowing this family to make a living on the land, which they otherwise couldn't. And if we're going to live in a rural area, we got to respect how people make their livings.
And by the way, they're not just making a living. They're creating an opportunity for you to live because they're producing food, fiber, pharmaceuticals, and fuel, which you might at some point need.
Yeah. And oh, by the way, we use their turkey litter to enrich our hay fields, which produced our hay production by 3.5 times.
Yeah. We've had a big movement in Nebraska with poultry growth, and I have countless friends who put chicken barns on their farms, not because they wanted to take care of chickens, because they wanted access to that litter, because it is some of the best, or it's plant food, and people get all bent out of shape about it. I guarantee you that guy who was talking about that danger of applying those manure to the field was also an organic zealot. Well, this is just organic plant food. Plants need nutrients to grow. It's continuing the cycle of life. Jim, I got to ask you before we run out of time, and we have 5 minutes, just so you know, I'm trying to get a better visual of this Game B proto in Oregon, because at this point I'm thinking like a little commune. What exactly does this look like?
Yeah, at some level, it kind of looks like a bit of a commune, only it will not be organized communally, probably. And this is one of the interesting things about Game B is that we believe in pluralism. People should try different things. And a proto-B could be anything from a suburban subdivision with a built-in CSA, community-supported agriculture, mm-hmm. up to a full-on commune. And I suspect that some people will want to operate a proto-B that way, because, again, with this idea of epistemic humility, we don't really know what will work for sure. So we're encouraging people to try different things in their proto-Bs and to communicate with each other. And it's one of the reasons we built this online system, so we can share our learnings. And over time, we'll converge towards that which works. So we're non-ideological, non-doctrinaire, and pragmatic. And so each one will be different. I think this first one will be probably a bit more communal than average. But the next one will look a lot more like a village-oriented residential subdivision with a organic built, not organic food, but a built-in 200-acre farm associated with it, where everybody will be a member of the CSA.
Mm. And so people just decide this is something they want to start and initiate it and are part of the group?
Yep. And the group will help them think through, you know, what their constitution should look like, give them ideas on how to structure their financing so that it's realistic and it isn't just hippy dippy dreams, can help in some cases round up the capital, though that's always the challenge, as we know, and give people access to things like sewer and water experts. That turns out to be a big one, right? Mm-hmm. You know, should you build your own package sewer plant? Or do you have enough drainage in your soil that septic, works? You got to figure that stuff out before you have to be pragmatic. You have to do things that are realistic and that will work.
So in the final 2 minutes, Jim, of all the things we talked about today, and obviously I'm passionate about your growth and livestock in the local area. The indoctrination, your word, of our kids through our school system, to me, is the gravest danger we have happening. Kelly and I have gotten more involved as we can in our local school system in the past year and a half because of obese spending and just learning the inner workings. I hope that everybody follows suit, whether you have kids in the school, local school or not. We need to all show up at these school board meetings because there is no, we talk about the waste and the gross overreach and the $1.9 trillion stimulus package that was just passed. At the same proportion, you have gross overspending and overreach in your local school system. And I hope that people take heed and go sit in on school board meetings and use that 3-minute comment period that you get every single Open Meetings Act meeting that you attend, because people need to hear what you have to say and be involved and at least feel the pressure of what you put on and teaching kids, not indoctrinating.
Absolutely. And run for office. My wife organized a group and we lived in New Mexico and they took over the school board. It wasn't that hard. Not that many people want to be on the school board. And so you can even go a step further and capture it for the good.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll just tell you how emotional it is in our little community of 850 people. K through 12, we have 157 students. We had 12 people running for 5 seats on the school board in the last election. That tells you there's issues. So, all right, Jim, we're 1 minute. What do you want us to most know, and where can people go find the Jim Rutt Show?
Okay, jimruttshow.com and or your favorite podcast app. Just type in Jim Rutt Show, and you'll get access to our 150 plus episodes where we have guests that talk about all kinds of things from science and technology to social change to righteous education to the philosophy of consciousness and everything in between. And don't forget game-b.org if you would like to find the others and help us build towards a sane next cycle for our society.
That's awesome. Game B, a commune coming to a town near you soon. I'm just kidding with that. Unless that's what you want. It's all about self choices. And Gail, I absolutely agree. I see superintendents that create walls between board members and teachers, and that is the problem. We have successfully journeyed down the road connecting rural and urban America. Jim Rutt and I both remind you that all roads do lead to a rural route with independent thinking. And just let me remind you quickly, the stand at Paxton County. Have you watched it? You could eat some certified Piedmontese that's been evaluated by Neogen while watching the stand at Paxton County on Netflix. Enjoy the weekend. It really illustrates what's been happening, folks. The stand at Paxton County on Netflix.